Hello, listeners. This is Accents, a podcast hosted by WUKY. This episode has been brought to you by Kentucky Humanities and the Kentucky Book Festival. I'm your host, Katerina Stoikova, and my guest today is poet and farmer Bernard Clay. Hi, Bernard. Thank you for coming to the studio.
Thank you, Katerina, for having me. I appreciate you.
The question that I want to know the answer the most is, what are you writing these days?
I'm working on new poems, of course, right about living in Berea and adjusting to Berea. So that's been the focus of a lot of my new poetry. I'm also working on another project with another writer. We're still in development and still have not solidified or finalized, I guess, the approach, but it's not going to be poetry. It's going to be prose. More to come on that one. I'm not going to talk too much about it besides I'm collaborating with somebody, and we've been writing since last year on something.
Wow, I'm not going to press the issue, but I have all sorts of questions and I am all sorts of excited.
Okay, maybe I can answer some of them.
Well, I mean, if you would be at least willing to name the person.
Jim Minnick, who's from Virginia, goes to the Hyman Settlement School a lot. He's pretty close to Appalachian writers all over.
He is fabulous.
Yeah.
He's fabulous.
This probably would be more nonfiction. We were toying, and we're still toying with the idea of epistolary type situation. So it'll be an exchange of ideas, I guess.
Wow.
So I think it's more just talking about our daily lives as writers, as stewards of land, as people in Kentucky. He's a white man, and I'm a black man, and our different takes on different things from those perspectives.
There is a lot of value in that already, in that dialogue.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and the joint stewardship of the earth, also there is a lot of value in that.
Yeah. So we'll see where that goes. Right now it's still sort of in flux and hasn't.
It will show
finalized.
Itself.
Yeah. Finalized yet. But other than that, I've writing my own poetry. I've been trying to sort of, I think I'm going to probably pull together a collection around just my first impressions of trying to acclimate myself to Appalachia, I guess, as a transplant.
Transplant from where? From Louisville?
From Louisville, Probably some of the poems I'll read here are sort of exemplify that. So,
well, let me ask you this, because you said that you're getting used to Berea. How long does it take one to get used to Berea?
I've been there since 2019. I don't know. I guess it depends on who you are.
You're an urban kid, right?
Yeah. I mean, I like the outdoors. I'm not like adverse to the outdoors. I probably like the outdoors more than most of my neighbors do. But it's a different cultural situation there. So it's just a lot of things we didn't know before we moved there. It's very, not religious, I guess religious. Yeah. It's like more religious than we were expecting. We were thinking, oh, it's a liberal college town, but there's a liberal college bubble in the town, but the town is very much what you would expect from an Eastern Kentucky town, I guess. Hmm. Very, very red state-ish, I guess.
So you live and work at Scorpion Hollow Farm. Is that true?
Yes.
Tell us more about that place.
We moved in in 2019, and it was because of my partner, Lauren. So she's a practicing herbalist, and we also always wanted to grow stuff. we've grown stuff. We've had gardens ever since we sort of got together. We found some land, and she wanted to establish herself in Berea because she was under the impression that it was also liberal and that an herbalist was needed there. She would have an easier time with it in Berea as opposed to like Louisville, where it was multiple herbalists there and it would have been hard to sort of establish herself. So we moved there because, yeah, mostly we've always said we were going to move to the country. So Scorpion Hollow is about 8 acres. And it's really mostly forested. We have probably like about 2 acres that are not forested. And it's mostly in a holler, so it's up a hill. Like, it's just half of it's going up a hill, and it's wooded. So it's not very usable land for the most part of it. So we have about 1 acre that we grow on. And then the rest of the land, we just let go to meadow. It's called Scorpion Hollow because when we moved in, there were a lot of scorpions.
How is that even possible?
Yeah, I don't know. Supposedly, there's a species of scorpions that live in Kentucky, and we happen to be in the area where they live. And I think they exclusively live on our hill because we talk to our neighbors, and they don't have them.
So actually, you could walk up a hill on your farm and see living, breeding scorpion.
If you lift up a rock, yeah.
Wow.
And when we first moved in, they were in the house. I mean, they still get in the house. I have to like spray around the house every 6 months to keep them out, or they'll start coming in and they'll sting. My partner's been stung. I've never been stung. Yeah. My partner's been stung. My dogs have been stung. So it's a real thing. They're about like maybe 2 or 3 inches big.
That sounds horrifying to me.
Yeah, it was at first, and then after a while you get used to it. But yeah, it's one of the creatures that live in Scorpion Hollow, among others. We have like crawdads too that live under our garden that are huge. Like huge crawdads. I've seen one that's
but you can eat those, right?
I'm not going to eat them, but
really, why not?
I wouldn't trust any of the water running off of these properties just because I don't know what they're putting on their lawns.
So do you check your shoes for scorpions before you put them on in the morning?
I really should. I don't, but I should. I should.
If I didn't know you, I would say that you're a liar, you know, to tell me those things.
No, like I have footage. I have pictures of scorpions.
I believe you.
Yeah. Like, and according to my partner, it feels like a wasp thing. Like, it's like, I've yet to, we also have a lot of centipedes and millipedes and all types of other creatures.
Have you written poems about those scorpions?
No. I have not written one, but that's a good idea. I think I might, yeah, you just, it never would occur to me, but yeah, I should write about the scorpions.
Please describe the creative life on the farm.
If you're talking about writing, it is a little different, and it's a little better in regard that you have more time for yourself, I guess. In a city, at least when I lived in a city, I was like interacting more. So there was like I had work, and then there was like this interaction time. That sort of came about where you interacted with people. But that also spurred a lot of inspiration. You had all these events happening in your life where they could inspire stuff or you could pull from. When you're in a rural setting, you're sort of, unless you have a lot of friends, which I do not, I don't have any friends in Berea, a lot of the time is spent by myself outside. So you have a lot of time to contemplate things, but maybe it's just, maybe you start thinking about things that you only care about because you're not really interacting with anybody. I don't know.
So there is isolation involved.
Yes. There's isolation, but you also are not isolated because then you start to sort of realize, your connection with nature, and how you're not really apart from it, but a part of it. It's put things in perspective. I used to, I wasn't really gung-ho about being a writer, quote-unquote writer, but it put it in perspective to me that I shouldn't force myself to write.
Yeah.
I should enjoy the things in life. And if writing is a byproduct of my observation of the world, that's a plus, but I shouldn't be bent out of shape if I can't, you know, if I'm not writing constantly. My creative life has actually improved tremendously since I've been out there, actually. I feel like I could possibly get a book out and not take 30 years to write it like I did my first book. So that's one thing.
I poked around your Facebook page and found a profile photo with a chicken.
Yeah. Rasputin.
Tell us more.
Yeah. I like chickens. So I believe in sustainable farming, which means that I don't use any real chemical inputs into my garden. I try to use either like compost, or I try to put material on my garden that breaks down and builds the soil. One of those materials is chicken manure. I bet that's the more proper way to say it. Chicken manure.
This is a podcast, anything goes.
Okay.
Any words. But we get it.
Yeah, yeah. So that was the main reason I got chickens. The byproduct is we get eggs all the time, and that's good. And they sort of, you know, before I had chickens, I really, you know, I went by the old adage, you know, they were bird-brained, not very smart, don't have personalities. But they all sort of do have personalities if you hang out with them enough. Really complex creatures. I was like, I'm not going to name them. And now I give them names, and they greet me when I come down to the garden and follow me around all over the garden. I guess I'm a farmer with chickens now, and yeah, it's cool.
And one of them is named Rasputin?
One of them's name is Rasputin. One of them's named Opal. I have two named Jen and Jer, but they're just red chickens, so I just split Ginger up between Jen and Jer for some stupid reason.
That's part of the creative life, naming chickens. I love it.
And then I have Blondie, who's a blonde color, so that wasn't that creative, but yeah, I mostly were naming them based on their color. I call Rasputin Rasputin because she has a beard. I think she actually answers to it. She's pretty smart for a chicken.
I would love to hear a few poems.
Oh, okay. This one's called Elegy for Eastern Kentucky Grocery. How does an oasis drown in a desert? Does it really matter once it's gone? Once the owls and everything in them breaks down and compiles in a disintegrated heap out on a parking lot in front of that hometown proud sign taunting those driving by, having to go 40 more minutes for some damn fresh food. Over 50 years, Gwen's been here, where most black folks call sundown country, holding her hamlet down as a cornerstone with reasonably priced meats and staples, right between Cap's Barbershop and Super Dollar. Unapologetically black and Appalachian, independent and owner, untouched all this time. Cause who's gonna bite the only hand that feeds them, no matter the color? But why resurrect this place? It can easily be taken away again. That Rock House Creek isn't going anywhere. But the sentiment passes quick, cause Gwen's not built like that. She puts this community on her back, converting the skeleton of her storefront into a triage, and calls all in need down from the hills, which in this age attracts the viral content spotlight, leading to national morning shows invites, to Broadway tickets, to state acclamations from the governor, to comically and monetarily large checks and corporate support to not just rebuild, but modernize the whole building. And of course, Gwen calmly takes it all in with poise. Cause one day the red IGA sign will be a LEED beacon in Isom again.
And by desert, you of course refer to food desert, right?
Yes, yes. That's the insinuation, because they had to go so far. Which is a problem out in rural areas and in inner city urban areas. A holler hello, or your mouths may vary in Appalachia, is the name of this poem. Hospitality hops them into their full-size trucks, gnawing up the gravel skin whittled in the contours leading up to your front door. Riding tornadic, opaque clouds, they appear and then clear like their dead, lighter, flint-flicked smiles will when they finally set eyes on you. Without a hello, they'll football toss the tight aluminum clutch of zucchini bread, which will be the best you've ever had, buttery and sweet, dark green skinned chunks of squash meat, like the five-star Foxfire chef put both feet in to this delicacy. It will still be warm in your hand, as warm as a Black Baptist church in rural Kentucky on the third Sunday in May, warmer than the way they'll say exclusively to your partner, with icebox eyes, who you church with. Their truck doors will be slammed and tires will be a spinning before she gets the lick out informally Catholic, swallowing a gritty cloud as they blow coal, spit limestone shrapnels at both your shins, and will never grace your threshold again. But that bread would have you changing sex in a sec. This one's called A Micro Essay on Ornamental Grass. You call me fescue, Bermuda, or even Kentucky bluegrass, like I've been here over here all along. But like you, I'm just a feudal remnant, haphazardly broadcast across dispossessed lands. The colonizer's blueprint, a rolled out carpet of familiar Eurasian green ahead of your arrival, savagely replacing all the native big blue stem stands and gamma grasses and switchgrasses that multiculturally bunched across the savannah with my sunburnable blades of homogeneity, which collapse with every frequenting drought, with my shallow roots that shed off millennia of spongy topsoil and retain no moisture with every growingly intense storm. I was that scout who softened this land for your ancestors' conquests. Maybe that's why now you spend 3 to 6 hours a week worshiping me, listening to the putter of horsepower piston popping zero turn sermons, suppressing any attempt of the natural and the diverse to supplant me with your cultist ceremonies of petro-fertilizing baptisms and routine mass circumcisions at the front yard church of the perpetually pruned and pristine holy lawns of your fathers, unaware of your deification of me, or otherwise, you would call me something else. Thank you.
These are wonderful.
I mean,
I can hear your voice, but the setting has changed. And I'm comparing them to English Lit, of course.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
How far away are you from having a book?
I would need 50 points. So I would say you need about 50 poems, right? Or 50 pages to at least get the minimum. So, yeah, probably not too far from a chapbook. Probably, you know, a little bit further away from a full-length poetry book. So we'll see.
Do you have a working title? Or you're not thinking that far yet?
No, I can't. That's hard for me to do. I'm not, like, deliberate like that, and I probably should be. This is probably good for me to think like that, because I'm more like, oh. Because I also have, like, a collection where I'm writing, and I didn't really talk about this, but I'm writing a collection about my family history. And so I'm just like doing the, I'm just doing whichever one is like, or I'll write on the epistolary. It's just whatever comes to me in a fit of inspiration. And just a lot of these were sort of like, just I'm reflecting on my time here and I'm trying to write a poem a day. So I'm going to write about this. So I can't say what the name of it is going to be. It may be a self-titled or a piece based on the poem title, or I don't know. Your miles may vary in Appalachia, I guess would be.
That is a great title. I have found that being deliberate about my material and thinking of it in projects just shortens the time by like 3/4.
Okay.
At least.
Okay.
So
yeah, I'm not against it. It's just not how my brain works, but it makes you accountable if you think of it like that. And it makes you want to like, okay, I got to compile this piece of work for this voice. Like doing English Lit was sort of like taking all these disparate poems that I've written over 30 years and trying to construct a narrative with it. Now I can just construct the narrative fresh, right? So it should take less time. It probably will take less. You're right. It will take less time because I'm not trying to like fit stuff into a narrative. I can like
write towards it.
Yeah.
And I mean, once you know what you're writing towards, you can hear the conversations. You can see the situation in Dollar General or whatever it happened to be in that area.
That's also a good. Good idea for a poem, right about the Dollar General. You're right. Thanks. I think I'll take that advice and think about it more deliberately. I hadn't been because...
I don't dare give advice.
I'm not a typical writer, I guess. I'm not sending my stuff out or sending, you know, manuscripts out and things. I've never been that type of writer. And so I write... mostly to articulate views about things. And I had I was basically writing to go to poetry readings because I knew that's where I could get those out. And I always like connecting with the audience when I read them.
You know, poetry readings are life and death kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
They are so important.
Yeah.
Eliciting work.
Mm-hmm.
For work to exist and to be spoken out loud. I'm grateful for them.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I was writing for. I mean, that was all those poems in English Lit were forged in the fire of Appalachian workshops and Appalachian poet readings. Like, we would have a reading once a month in the King Cultural Center and the now defunct Student Center. That's where I would, I got, used to sort of reading and finding my voice. Finding how to connect with the audience with the words. I agree with you. I mean, it almost pains me that sometimes you do have to write poems that are probably exclusively work on the page because I can't really read those out. Or they don't work as well when you read them. So generally, I like to write poems that work on the page and hopefully when you read them too.
English Lit, your one and only so far collection. It was a huge success. It was much awaited. And I remember, like, I met you at the Kentucky Book Festival, out of all places, and we both had new books at the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
I read the book, and I loved it.
Mm. Well, thank you.
I loved the sense of humor. I loved the satire. I love the storytelling, and they're so memorable. I would love to hear several poems from English Lit if you want to read them.
Okay. So let me read. I'll read the title poem. Yeah. Okay.
Not too many people can do humor the way you do, Bernard.
Thank you. It was more me. I wasn't trying to be too funny. I was actually sort of angry when I wrote this. It is a nice thumb a nose thumb to academia. No offense to people in academia. I respect academia immensely, so don't hold this poem against me. This is English Lit. English Lit ain't never meant shit to me, a griot from urban decay. I care less about the way the Middle English or even their contemporaries display their masturbation, a.k.a. mastery of a native tongue sprung from spliced together stolen components of failed conquest-thirsty cultures. Meanwhile, I carry an $80 leather-bound 50-pound edition that I don't even read, sitting in classrooms full of white girls who aspire to be teachers or pontificating writers like the self-absorbed ones up front, jacking their egos for hours straight about imagined intricate insignificant details of forced literary regurgitation and their slightly different postmodern imitations. They talk about my limitations on papers and in my daily speech, yet I still continue to reach to the streets, representing, even though they be hinting with C minuses and D pluses, that my attempts at writing should cease and desist. But my claim to fame is not only as a writer, but also an arsonist. Because every time that my pen and paper hit, I receive great joy at watching the Queen's English being lit. I'll read this one because it's a, I rarely read it. And it talks about family and nature. Birmingham Forest, early spring. The pink and the white and the lilac and the dogwood and the pear and the redbud are lace fastened to the blue and frolic under the spiny green horizon. On rare weekends, we took day trips out of the humming city with Daddy and the orange Volvo wagon, jammed with family and ice pack coolers filled with black cherry Bic K sodas, Funyuns, and tuna salad. On, out there, pondside, at spongy picnic tables, when the chewing stopped, we could hear the sun barreling through space, hear the trees' buds opening above, hear the red-bellied speckled woodpecker warble rolling from their speckled throat lash, or just hear nothing at all.
So beautiful.
The good couch. In the living room sat the couch, one of them splurge items, an oatmeal tweed burlap thing purchased spontaneously at Value City. And for the good couch reason, my parents covered it with a sheet of plastic, a heavy synthetic skin that rustled with every motion. When summer smothered up, scorching hot days back when home AC was a myth to me, something not felt but alluded to on TV. On those simmering evenings, primetime bubbled across blue flickering screens, couch filled to capacity with family, and box fans propped in windows, making our house a convection oven. We would broil on that couch, as its transparent epidermis bonded with our bare arms and legs, so that, of course, I would have to wait until the next commercial break, because the sound of me ripping clean from the Velcro couch would have drowned out the TV a bit, and everybody would have thrown a fit, because Cosby might have said something witty in his air-conditioned brownstone.
You know, this is so evocative. I sat on that couch. You know, I felt my skin rip off.
Oh, really?
Yes. I mean, this is great.
Generally, I get, when I read that, at least one person always comes up and is like, yeah, my aunt had a couch just like that. My grandma had a couch just like that. Which was like, I was like, oh, I didn't realize that. I was like, I didn't realize that was just a normal thing, but I guess it was, especially in the 70s. If you come up through the 70s and early 80s, it was a big thing. I'll read Field Trip.
Okay. That's another classic.
It is? Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Totally.
Okay. Field Trip. A first grade excursion to the zoo becomes a safari through the neighborhood that surrounds the school that most of my classmates are bused to every morning. We burrow through the dense poverty and lush decay. Some kids bury their gaze into seat backs like ostriches. Some kids leer out the panes, eyes popping like lemurs. Some kids look back at me like I'm a gazelle chased by a cheetah surrounded by lions. Misreading their attention, I act as an exotic guide, answering questions about the flora and fauna, even pointing out my home to a collective gasp and pity glance. Then the chaperone mom steps in. I lived there too, before this place went to hell. All the kids' mouths are agape like hippos. Then the mom's face turns baboon butt red, and she apologizes for swearing. The rest of the way through the industrial park, we fog the windows, singing Old MacDonald like a flock of egrets and one crow until we get to where the real animals are.
Hey, Bernard.
Yes.
Tell us about your relationship with the earth.
It's probably the most important relationship you have, I think, is your relationship with the earth. It's something that I've grown into. Like, I will say, there's been sort of like a curve, like maybe a bell curve, actually. Yeah. Very early on, I was really into the earth, like most kids were. But I was really, really into the earth. My mom had a garden. My grandmother had a garden. I just loved being outside. And then sort of as I went to school and became educated through our education system, I became more detached from it. Always sort of like wanting to go back, but just getting sucked into like living a city-fied life where, you know, nature isn't really considered, I guess. As I gotten older and I become more mature and I had more control over my life and I also started, you know, supporting my own self, I've been able to sort of find people around me who also like the earth, including my partner and a lot of my friends. And this has sort of facilitated me to be able to go outside, give myself permission to go outside, do hikes, grow food. I built a garden for my mom. That sort of sparked, hey, you know, I can get back into this. And then when I eventually owned my home, we had a garden. We had a community garden. And just over the course of the past few years, I've become more and more like enthralled in being outside, allowing the earth to provide vegetation and beauty, like treat it like it's, you know, I'm not like not a very religious person or somebody who believes in like religious ideas, but to sort of take part in what is going on that is probably greater than what we think of as our human civilization. I don't have anything against being civilized, but I just think that there's a bigger thing going on with humans and the earth than what we have going on between ourselves. And so, yeah, it's very important. I don't know if I answered your question, but
you did. You totally did. And now I want to mention three Accents Publishing poets. One of them is Eric Scott Sutherland, who wrote the book Earth is My Church.
Okay.
And he talks about some of the sentiments that you just mentioned. The other one, I guess it's not, he's a friend of mine. He is not Accents Publishing author. His name is Chris Mattingly. Chris has this practice that when he writes a poem, he prints a copy and he goes in his backyard and he buries it into the earth.
Nice.
Right. Isn't it? I mean, it's like, okay, this is ultimately our words belong to the earth. It's unignorable relationship. And the third Accents Publishing author I want to mention is Greg Pape, who writes a lot about chickens. He has a series of poems about chickens that I think you will love.
Okay. It'd be good to see some other poets that sort of share the sentiment that I have. I know there are, and I definitely read poems about it.
We don't write enough about the earth, I don't think.
Yeah.
We don't do enough about the earth.
Because people care more about what's, like I said, what's going on between us.
Right.
Which is, it seems like it's important on a very ephemeral level, important. But the things about a relationship with the earth are like lasting, there's lasting impact. And the fact that we have sort of withdrawn from that relationship has had a lasting impact, as we can see, on the earth and our viability as a species.
What you're saying is absolutely true. I feel like I myself have withdrawn somewhat from my relationship with the earth, and that is because of sense of powerlessness about what's going on.
Yeah.
And despondency, in kind of like, I cannot handle that, worrying about that as well.
Right. But you can still have a relationship with the planet. The planet, this is, and I get in this discussion with my partner, Lauren, a lot. The planet is going to be fine. It's going to adjust and adapt to whatever we do to it.
After, do you think so?
Yeah.
Like after we're gone, or?
Yeah, after we're gone. Yeah.
Not before that, though.
No, but that's the thing. It's sort of like, we are smart enough to know that this is, but we don't care. And so if that means the trade-off is, you know what I'm saying? It's sort of like, either we're going to figure it out or we're not. But either way, the Earth's going to be here.
And then who do you root for? The Earth or for the human beings who are destroying it? You know, I kind of happen to root for the Earth.
Yeah. Well, and it's the thing is, it's sort of like, you can still have that relationship with the Earth because it's still here. Yeah, if you see it from the context of our civilization, it is sort of bleak.
Yeah.
But if you see it from a perspective that this is a magnificent planet and the things that happen on it are amazing, and just sort of suck into that or get sucked in by that, I don't know. I find myself not so depressed when I'm out there. When you're walking in the woods, on creek beds and in the fields, I mean, yeah, sometimes you hear like a lawnmower, like I was talking about, but once the lawnmower stops, you know, you'll hear what makes it what it is. Species are getting annihilated by us and things are happening, but it's very arrogant to think that we can sustain and outlast what we're doing. There's a very narrow band of survivability for us, and yes, once we get out of that, then we're
or once we push ourselves out of that.
Right.
Yeah.
That's what, so it's sort of like, I would like to think we're going to eventually get smart enough, or maybe it's too late.
Maybe the next generation.
Yeah. I don't know. It's rough. It's a rough thing to think about.
Yeah.
But that's what us as writers are supposed to bring.
I have one more question for you.
Yes.
Because you raise herbs. Mm-hmm. Is there an herb that all of us should eat for our health?
I would say there isn't a fix-all silver bullet herb. So you should probably just grow like a suite of herbs. And if I was going to say what suite you should grow, it should be rosemary, thyme, bee balm.
What about mint?
Mint, yeah. Mint is good. Like, I would say if you're going to grow mint, grow peppermint. It's less likely to take over your garden. If you grow spearmint, it'll sort of goes crazy in this part of the country. You know, there's all types of herbs. We grow, like, lobelia. We grow skullcap. We grow valerian. We grow all these medicinal herbs. And they're so easy to grow. Really, everybody could grow their own apothecary and heal their aches and pains as they come across them. As long as they're not acute, you could generally help yourself. There's also forest-based herbs like golden seal, blue and black cohosh. Golden seal is like a if there was a silver bullet, Golden Seal would sort of be it. It sort of helps with a lot of things. It's also, you're not supposed to take it like frequently, but it does heal a lot of different things. But I'm not the herbalist, Lauren is, so I can only speak to it at a very high level. But if I was going to grow, I would grow a suite of them and then expand out from there. Like, there's no excuse for people not to have a herb garden because it's so easy.
Well, there it is. You know, apothecary on a windowsill in a city environment. Yeah. And, you know, if you have a patch of land, then you can just plant it in the earth.
Instead of having a lawn, just grow a bunch of thyme and rosemary. Kill your lawn. I said it. Yes, kill your lawn. You should not have a lawn.
Why not?
A, the grasses that grow in your lawn are not a naturalized vegetation here. It doesn't do your soil any favors, and the maintenance on it is destructive. You have to either mow it or get it treated. All the way around, lawns are bad, no matter if you don't have to water it or not. But if you do have to water it, that's even worse. If there's any type of maintenance on it beyond cutting it, that's even worse. But cutting it is bad. You're like, there's all types of noxious fumes that get put off by lawnmowers when you cut them. And like, it's not pretty. It's not diverse. It's boring. It's mono. It's a monocultural thing. And it's just, I don't know. It's sort of boring. People get upset. You probably get hate mail if this gets out to anybody. Fruit was like, why is he talking about lawns? Lawns are beautiful.
You know, we're an equal opportunity offender here on this podcast. So so I think we're doing well. I really appreciate you, Bernard, coming to the show and reading us poems and telling us your opinions. And for giving us the suite of herbs for us to heal our aches and pains.
Yeah, I couldn't think of a better word than sweet.
That's perfect. Okay. Yeah. And best of luck with your writing.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. And I will take your advice. I think I'm going to be very deliberate about these collections I'm writing.